there he was, all alone, in the darkness of the night. None of his family were with him. None of his servants were with him. None of his possessions were with him. He was all alone. And somebody came and wrestled with him all night long. And neither wrestler could prevail against the other, because they were both strong, and they were both stubborn, and they were both determined to win. Jacob even got his hip broken in the wrestling match, but he wouldn't let go. He would not let go unless the person he was wrestling with gave him his blessing and told him his name. But the other wrestler refused to tell Jacob his name. But he gave Jacob a new name. He called him Israel, which means you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed. There he was, in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of his life, wrestling with this stranger. And the text is wonderfully ambiguous. It does not give us the slightest clue who this stranger is. Sometimes it doesn't even give us the slightest clue what the antecedent of the pronoun he is. Who was this stranger? Was it God? Was it his brother Esau? Was it his own psyche, his own inner demons? Interpreters have taken this story any of these ways, and we're free to do that. But to get a glimpse into what this story might mean to you, I think we need to hear the larger story. And of course, we heard the beginning of it last week, when we heard about the fact that before he was even born, Jacob was wrestling. He wrestled with his brother Esau in his mother's womb. The two brothers were struggling together, wrestling together to see who could come out first and get the birthright that came with being the firstborn. And Jacob was not as strong as Esau. Esau won that wrestling match. He was born first, but Jacob would not let go. He was born holding on to Esau's ankle. And he didn't stop struggling then. He lost the battle for the birthright, but that didn't mean he did not keep striving to win it back. And he was brighter than his brother Esau, and so he kept looking for his opportunity. And that opportunity came, as we heard last week, when one day Jacob had stayed at home cooking a pot of lentil stew, and Esau had been working in the fields all day. And when Esau came in, he was hungry, he was tired, he was famished. And he said, "Give me some of that red stuff to gulp down." That inarticulateness shows where he's coming from. He was not an intellectual. He could not think abstractly. He could not think strategically. All he knew were his own present hungers. And he asked for a bowl of stew, and Jacob pounced on the opportunity and said, "Give me your birthright, and I'll give you a bowl of stew." And Esau said, "What good is a birthright to me?" And he made the trade. But the struggle didn't stop then. Sometime later, their father Isaac was on his deathbed. He was about to die, and he called to him his favorite son, Esau. And he said, "Before I die, would you go out and hunt some of that game that I like so much and bring it back and cook it the way I like? And after I've had this final meal, I will give you my final blessing, my son Esau." And so Esau went out and did as his father asked him. But his mother, Rebekah, had heard what had been spoken between the two of them. And she called to herself her favorite son, Jacob, and said, "Quick, While Esau's gone, I'm going to kill one of the animals in the yard and cook it the way your dad likes. You dress in Esau's clothes so you smell like him. He's blind. He won't know who it is. And then you take the meal that I've prepared into your father and feed it to him, and he'll give you his final blessing. And because Isaac was blind and because he was weak and old and dying, he gave his final blessing to Jacob. And then Esau gets back home with the meal he's prepared, and he goes into his father, and his father says, but I've already given my blessing to Jacob. I can't take it back. I can't give it to you. And Esau gets so angry that he vows that after the period of mourning for his father's death is over, he's going to murder his brother, tear him limb from limb. And again, Rebekah hears what's going on and sends Jacob back to their ancestral hometown of Haran, where he can be safe. So Jacob leaves home. He's won the birthright, but he dare not show his face to Esau after the funeral. So he goes back to Haran. Now, what happens to Jacob in Haran is a pretty interesting thing. He goes to the village well to draw himself a drink because he's thirsty. There at the well, he sees this beautiful young woman by the name of Rachel. And he falls in love with this woman, and he asks her to take him to see her father, which he does. And he asks her father, Laban, for Rachel's hand in marriage. And Laban says, well, I have an older daughter. It's not right for the younger daughter to be married first. Say, you work for me for 7 years, and I'll give you the hand of Rachel in marriage. So Jacob works 7 years for Laban. And when the 7 years are over, the wedding feast is held, and everybody is merry and celebrates and maybe gets a little tipsy. And then after the wedding, when Jacob is in the bridegroom's tent in the middle of the night, Laban sends not Rachel, but the older daughter, Leah, into that tent. And because it's dark and because he can't see, he consummates his marriage with the wrong sister. Now, the same thing that he had pulled on his father now gets pulled on him. And he goes back to Leah, to Laban the next morning and says, what have you done to me? You've cheated me. And Laban says, well, you want to marry Rachel? Work for me 7 more years. What's he going to do? He's in love. So he works 7 more years for Laban. And at the end of those 7 years, he gets to marry Rachel. And in the meantime, both of his wives are fertile. He ends up having a total of about 12 children, 12 sons. But eventually, the day comes when he realizes he has to go back home again. He's run away from home. He's run away from the conflict. He's run away from his problems. He's run away from his brother Esau, who threatened to murder him last time he saw his face. He realizes that his purpose in life cannot be fulfilled in Haran. He is meant to be the leader of the family. He now has the birthright. He has to go back home. And so he heads back home with his two wives and his children and his animals and his possessions. And the night before he gets back home, the night before the reunion with his brother, with so much bad blood between him, the night before he has to face Esau again, he sends his family across the Jabbok River. He sends his servants and his possessions across the river, and he spends the night by himself on the other side of the river. And there, in the darkness, he wrestled all night long. Who was he wrestling with? Was he wrestling with an angel? Was he wrestling with God? Was he wrestling with his brother Esau? Was he wrestling with his inner demons? Interpreters have taken this story all of these directions. What I want to say is that this is what faith is like. Faith is all about wrestling with the stuff in our lives, wrestling with our questions, wrestling with our doubts, wrestling with our conflicts, wrestling with one another, not ignoring the doubts and the conflicts, not trying to overwhelm them, but engaging them, wrestling with them, struggling with them in an even battle. Faith is all about wrestling with the stuff that troubles us in our hearts and in our minds and in our spirits. And in our own tradition, we know very well the story of another individual for whom faith was a matter of wrestling with himself and with God. His name was John Wesley. He was the founder of the Methodist movement. He was the 16th of 19 children born to Samuel Wesley, and a priest in the Church of England, and Susanna Wesley, Samuel's wife, who was the daughter of a Puritan minister. And as a young child, John was upstairs in the bedroom of the parsonage in which they lived in Epworth, England, when the parsonage caught on fire and burned to the ground, and John, being a toddler, was unable to escape from the bedroom, and he would have died in that inferno had not the men of the village done the heroic thing of forming a human ladder and rescuing him from his bedroom. And from that moment on, his mother, Susanna, would refer to him as a brand plucked from the burning, quoting an obscure passage of the Old Testament. And Susanna determined in her own heart that John had been saved from the fire because God had some powerful purpose intended for his life. And from that moment on, she made it her purpose to instill into John that this was his mission in life. Now, you can imagine that if you have an obsessive mother like that, trying to drill into your head that God has a special purpose for your life, that's both a blessing and a curse. And John certainly knew the curse side of that, because he followed in his father's footsteps. He did what he had to do to make his mom happy. He went to Oxford University. He became ordained a priest in the Church of England. He went into ministry, but he was miserable. His faith didn't bring him joy. His faith didn't bring him freedom. His faith didn't bring him a sense of God's acceptance and love, because his faith was a burden. His faith was an obligation that his mother had put on his shoulders, and he struggled. He felt he had to preach faith, but he didn't believe himself. He struggled. He was miserable. Now, what does a compulsive person do if you feel like you have to have stronger faith than you have? Well, a compulsive person will work even harder to do it. And so he joined an organization that called itself the Holy Club, a group of individuals who were very disciplined about their spiritual life. They would get up at 5 a.m. and pray and study the Bible. They would meet together and discuss their spiritual development and be accountable to one another. They would visit prisoners and minister to them like Jesus commanded. They were very methodical in their spiritual life, and because of this, people mockingly called them Methodists, which is where we got our name as a denomination. But did any of this make him happy? No. He's just working harder to get himself accepted, wrestling harder. And so he decided, maybe I ought to become a missionary. And he accepted a call to be a missionary in the American colony of Georgia, in the debtors' colony of Georgia. And so, you know, in those days, transportation wasn't a matter of going to Heathrow Airport and getting on an airplane and being there in 9 or 10 hours. It meant crossing the Atlantic Ocean in a small wooden ship, in a crowded hold with lots of other passengers. And in the course of the voyage across the Atlantic Ocean, that ship ran into a terrible storm. Rain was pouring down, the waves were crashing against the side of the ship. They were so high, the ship was tossing to and fro. He was afraid that the ship would capsize or sink, and that he would die out there in the middle of the ocean. And he was up on the deck because how could he be under the deck? He'd get seasick for sure. And he noticed, seated in a circle on the deck of that ship, were a group of Moravians traveling to the New World. And he noticed that they were just sitting and singing and praying together, and they were calm, and they were at peace. And he was astounded. And he went up to them and said, "How come you're not afraid? Not even your children and women are afraid." And somebody said to John, "Our women and children aren't afraid to die." And that was like a dagger in his heart because he knew his faith was not strong enough. He was afraid to die. Well, the ship made it safely across the Atlantic, and John made it safely to Savannah, Georgia, where he had a rather unremarkable ministry. I won't go into depth if you're interested. Look up John Wesley and Sophie and Google it. There's a really interesting story there. So he came back to England, an utter failure. The Holy Club stuff didn't work. The missionary stuff didn't work. The priesthood stuff didn't work. And one night, he writes in his journal, a friend had asked him to attend a prayer meeting with him. And he went unwillingly to a prayer meeting in a chapel on Aldersgate Street in the city of London. It was a Wednesday evening, May the 24th, 1738, a day that's called Aldersgate Day in our tradition. And he attended that meeting, and he writes in his journal that they were reading from the preface that Martin Luther wrote to his commentary on Paul's letter to the Romans. And in the part of his writings where Luther was talking about Paul's words that we are saved by faith, by grace, and not by works, John Wesley writes that I felt my heart strangely warmed. And in that moment, somehow I felt I did trust in God, and somehow an assurance was given me that I was acceptable in God's sight. And the wrestling match ended after 35 years of his life, and he discovered an experience of faith that gave him peace and assurance and power. And then he went out and he shared that experience all over England. He shared it with the common people, and there was a great hunger for it because the Anglican faith in the 18th century was deadly dull rational, and people were dying for faith with an emotional content. And Wesley provided a renewal movement in the Anglican church. He preached everywhere, in market squares, in racetracks, in factories, in mine shafts, and a great movement developed around him, but not until after he had struggled for so long, not until after he had wrestled for so long, until finally he was able to open up his heart and let go of the striving and simply accept that love and acceptance are gifts from God. One more thing. His brother Charles, as you know, was a great hymn writer. Charles Wesley wrote over 5,000 hymns in the course of his lifetime. Many of them are very famous.